This morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Bernardo Reyes, who is an assistant professor of geriatrics at FAU. He serves as the associate program director for the internal medicine program in the geriatric palliative rounds rotations. After finishing his internal medicine training, he relocated to Boston, where he joined the staff of Mass General and became an instructor there. He developed the first geriatric co-managed orthopedic service between MGH and Harvard Orthopedics. He then became the first Charlotte Bloomberg Fellow in Geriatric Medicine and was trained officially as a geriatrician. He then came down to Florida, and he originally was at Cleveland Clinic, and he's now here at FAU. This morning he's going to talk on perioperative management of older adults, something we never see here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me again. This is a subject that is dear to my heart. It has been something that I have worked since the beginning of my career, since I finished residency, actually. It's something that I think is so important, and it's amazing how things have changed throughout the years, where the concept of who can have surgery is no longer limited by age or by comorbid conditions. So this is something that I have no conflicts of interest associated with this talk. And let's start with, some fun facts. Who is this guy? Andy, right? So most of us know him for being a famous classic artist. He was a sick child. He spent a lot of his childhood in bed. And that's why people believe that he was inclined to drawing and writing. And his skills actually were built during that time. He was a wild person. Everybody knows that during the 60s and 70s, if you looked at, vintage news, you remember that Andy was a heavy drug user and consumed, large amounts of alcohol. So he had a lot of fun with a lot of fun people. He even survived a gunshot. Apparently one of his associates had some issues with him when he was trying to share the profits of one of the jobs that he did. And he got shot by this associate near to that, and he survived. Nonetheless, he died after a gallbladder procedure in a hospital in New York. So what I'm trying to say with this is that depending on how you see perioperative management, risk sometimes is not associated with the type of procedure, but with the type of patient. Andy Warhol died at age 59, so he was not considered an elder by our definitions, but his body definitely, if you see the pictures of the latter part of his life, you realize that this is a guy that had a lot of fun. And that actually led to his demise after this simple procedure. So today's objective, we're going to try to discuss the physiologic changes that are associated with aging, and they can affect outcomes in perioperative management. We're going to briefly describe the list of frequent complications that are associated with surgical procedures in older adults. And lastly, the later part of this lecture, and we're going to spend most of the time, is going to be describing the common features of these perioperative programs that are all around the country now. So, some facts. Between a third and 50% of every single procedure done in this country is performed in an older adult, okay? And that depends if you want to include endoscopies on those numbers. Despite having such a vast experience, older adults disproportionately suffer from complications of surgical procedures. That's why it's so important that we identify common risk factors that can be modified and mitigate the consequences or the complications of surgical interventions. So looking at a little bit of data, if you see, this is a national quality improvement program from the American College of Surgeons. And here they are describing a group of patients between the years of 2005 and 2006 that are underwent GI procedures. If you looked at morbidity and mortality, you can see that worsening outcomes are definitely associated with age. And again, I just want to be sure that we understand that aging is not the problem, okay? But obviously, the comorbid conditions and the other factors that are associated with poor outcomes in surgical patients are more prominent in the aging population. So a little bit of more facts. People really don't die in the day. How many times we have seen people now dying during an operation? I mean, it's very frequent. The surgeons in this room can tell us that happens less and less, okay? Even though we're pushing the envelope and we're operating in sicker and more frail people, really complications occurred right after or after the procedure. Most complications are independent on surgical skills. A very humble surgeon friend of mine actually explained once that surgery nowadays is like Formula One racing. So it's technology driven. The drivers actually got, I mean, when you're at the top of your game, it's very difficult actually to go above that curve, okay? And your outcomes, or the improvement of your outcomes, are mostly technology driven. And you have to spend, like in Formula One, a lot of money to get some few milliseconds out of the time. Most of the programs that have been reported in the literature suggest that pre-op optimization works. Okay? So, talking a bit more about complications, if you looked at the nature of the complications that occur in older adults undergoing surgery, and I'm going to quote, this is data from hospitals in Baltic countries or countries around the Baltic Sea. If you see, these are patients that undergo GI malignancy surgeries, and if you look at the nature of the complications, around a fifth of them can be attributed to some degree to the surgery itself, okay? Most of the other complications are associated mostly with comorbid conditions and functional status of the patient. So if you extrapolate this to something like this, you realize that in order to decrease risk, you have to focus in these 80% of the equation. The more you modify risk factors that you can, sorry for the redundancy, modify, the most likely you're going to have a better outcome. Okay? So timing and technique, although are extremely important, if you ask surgeons again, they will tell you that there is little that can be changed. Once your surgical skills are polished at the top of your career, there is little variance among your outcomes throughout. Mostly the patient defines what kind of outcomes the surgical intervention is going to have. So I presented in the same audience something similar. So we kind of timing, we decolonize the population in three buckets. Pretty much the people that need surgery now. Warhol, when he went to the hospital in New York after getting shot, and he needed surgery now. There is nothing we can do. There is little we can do. This guy needs to go to OR right now or die. Okay? People that might need surgery as soon as possible. And you know, the typical patient that fits in this category is a hip fracture. And then lastly, and the ones that we're going to discuss today, are the ones that might need surgery eventually, or the elective procedures, okay? So let's start with a couple of cases that run at the same time. So we have two patients, they're both females, they're 85, and they go to your office, you're in the PCP, and they go to your office for a scheduled surgery. They both have history of COPD that is well controlled. You're a PCP, you're doing a great job. They have high blood pressure and diabetes. Again, their diseases are well controlled. One of them lives by herself. walks every day to the store, play cards with friends three times a week. The other one lives with her daughter, uses a walker to ambulate, and needs assistance managing medications and finances. Both will have a comprehensive evaluation in your office. You will check pre-op labs, EKG, and a chest x-ray, and all those are normal. They both undergo their scheduled procedure. The one in your left undergoes the procedure without any complications. The other one gets agitated in the PACU, becomes resistant to care, pull her IV and her Foley, causing trauma and hematuria. The one on the left on post-op day one is out of bed, he's ambulating, the IV and the Foley are out, she's tolerating PO. The other one is not able to ambulate and has poor PO intake. The one on the left is using only medications as needed for pain, and again, he's moving, he's going in the right direction, while the other one actually, during one of the episodes of agitation, fell out of the bed and broke a hip. While the other one gets discharged on post-op day two, the other one might die in the hospital in a nursing home later on. So why these very similar patients have completely different outcomes? What is the difference? And again, stressing the fact that surgical techniques are extremely important. We always want to have great surgeons. But also, there is the counterpart on this equation is these issues. And if you see this graph, I purposely put comorbid condition in a smaller square. Why? Because as you age, there are other determinants of health that are usually knees because of the fast-paced way that we practice medicine nowadays. So issues like polypharmacy, social problems, functional status, nutrition, and cognition will have a heavier influence on the outcomes of these patients sometimes in comorbid conditions of the surgical technique itself. Older adults are unique. If you think about it, older adults that undergo surgery in this country, they have an average of 6 comorbid conditions when they go to the table. Most of them will have some degree of cognitive impairment, and even mild cognitive impairment has been associated with poor outcomes in this patient population. There are changes associated with aging, and that we'll describe it in a later part of the presentation. And there are always, as we age, function changes. Your ability to perform independently, your activities of daily living decreases with time. Let's go through some of the physiologic changes. So between the ages of 20 and 80, you lose 50% of your cardiac output. There is fibrosis that occurs in the myocardium, leading to stiffness, leading to diastolic and systolic dysfunction. And there is also increased arterial stiffness from the lack of production of nitric oxide at the endothelial level. So what the resulting changes are that you have a patient that is less likely to compensate for sudden changes in blood pressure or volume status that could occur during surgery. In terms of the respiratory capacity, as we age, there are changes that occur both in the parenchyma and in the wall chest. It's kind of like when you teach the fellows during the fellowship, usually you explain them that these changes are similar to the changes that occur in a patient with emphysema. Okay? It's mild, but those changes occur. There is, with aging as well, there is a significant decrease in the alveolar surface that is able to exchange oxygen and CO2, leading to mismatches in the VQ that are even can be seen in VQ scans. And, as a result of all these changes, elderly patients tend to breathe in a shallow manner and with higher frequency. We lose blood flow in both the spleen and the liver, leading to issues with or significant limitations with metabolizing some medications. And also remember that with age, by age 50, we lose up to 50% of all functional glomeruli, leading to problems actually clearing medications that are cleared by the kidneys. In terms of brain function, by age 80, I know this is kind of depressing sometimes, but we will go through the positive part of it. At age 80, we lose approximately 30% of our brain mass. Our ability to recall information and to produce new memories might be preserved, but our ability to process information in a fast-paced environment usually is reduced. That's why people that are able to tell you exactly, you know, they can't repeat 10 words. I mean, when you're testing for memory in these patients, they are able to repeat pretty much everything you tell them and have excellent recall, but they are not able to sometimes complete simple math equations in a short period of time. And again, as life expectancy continues to increase, there are a greater proportion of older adults that will undergo surgery that will have some degree of mild cognitive impairment. So where we're going with all this? So the most important part of any program is trying to identify who will benefit from it. And the traditional pre-op assessments, and this is a quote-unquote from one of the studies that I'm going to mention later, that traditional pre-op risk assessments, such as ASA and the physical classification system, they focus a lot on the medical issues. And they tend to miss other important factors like the ones that we have mentioned before. So this is one of my favorite ones. I mean, actually, you know, was designed by, again, the American College of Surgeons. They call it a quality improvement project. And this is a calculator you can get online. There is actually an app. The reason why I like it, it helps me through the informed consent process. So patients actually can see what are the actual risks of not only cardiovascular complications, but also respiratory complications, infection, urinary tract infections, venous thromboembolism, renal problems, and actually it calculates the risk of readmission. What I like the most is that this tool actually takes in, and I don't know if you can see it from there, but takes into consideration functional status. So in my opinion, if you want to use a single tool in your office that can help you through the informed consent and identify not only who is at risk, but who is at risk for what, this is a tool that you could use. Again, it's available online, it's for free, and actually there is an app for that. Why is this so important? Because no matter what type of program you put together in any institution, the only way that you can prove cost effectiveness is by selecting the right population. We learned that, by the way, when we established the STAR program here at Boca Regional. So with that in mind, appropriate screening is the first step of any program that you want to start. You really want to use a screening tool that helps you identify who is really at risk for adverse outcomes. So what are the common features of any enhanced perioperative program? So the first thing, as we mentioned, is screening. So you have to, you know, be sure that whatever tool you use is used in a standardized way, is available, and is reportable. So you can actually, if all of us use the same tools to identify who is at risk and at risk for what, it's going to be easier to coordinate the care of these patients. Every single assessment has to be based on guidelines. And as a geriatrician, from the younger generation, I have seen geriatrics change in the past, 7 years. Geriatrics is not anymore that specialty that was based on the experience of that I had for 25 years. There is a lot of evidence-based interventions that have that have been reported in the literature. And again, if you look at how the practice of geriatrics has changed one of the things that little room for argument is the fact that most of the interventions are evidence-based.
We need to be sure that we do targeted pre-op testing.
I always say to my residents, never order a test in the pre-op time that would not change the outcomes of the surgery. This is not the time while you're assessing these patients. This is not the time to get a PSA. This is not the time to get a cholesterol. This is the time to focus on what needs to be optimized for the patient to have the most successful surgery possible in a timely fashion, in a cost-effectiveness, value-based model. We have to be sure that that whatever plan we put together, there has to be also a component of intraoperative interventions. That's why it's so important to work with the surgeons. No program will work unless we communicate with the surgeons directly. That open channel of communication is extremely necessary. And also, no program will work if there is no post-operative, you know, surveillance and interventions to mitigate potential adverse outcomes. We have to use evidence-based information to make decisions about the use of blood products. There's plenty of data now, and there are plenty of data now in the literature suggesting that not using appropriate decision-making protocols to use blood products actually can lead to adverse outcomes. So having that information in hand and creating protocols that are expand throughout all the institutions, it will save not only resources, but also would improve the outcomes of the patients. Also, we need to include strategies to control pain. One of the things that the literature suggests is that pain control is perhaps one of the most effective interventions you can provide during the postoperative period. For older adults, the principle of pain control is that it has to be multimodal. And when we talk about multimodality of pain, we're not talking only about one, two, or three medications. We're also talking about non-pharmacological interventions, and they're extremely important and effective. And also, we need to learn the impact of structural and cultural factors related to the healthcare system. So here in South Florida, we have such a diverse population, and the expectations of families and caregivers is so different. And it really, there are so many sociocultural variability that not having those not putting those into consideration when we put the plan of care, we might fall short in terms of meeting the expectations of our patients. So we're going extremely fast, by the way. Do you have any questions? I'm sorry. I don't want to be there. So let's talk about the perioperative optimization of senior patients with the POSH program. Actually was designed in Duke and has been implemented already in several hospitals, including some of VA hospitals. The main objective of the program is to improve postoperative outcomes in high risk, and again, I want to highlight that, high risk seniors. The model involved geriatric experts, and I want to stress the fact that I'm saying geriatric experts, I'm not saying geriatricians, throughout the perioperative period. And it's based on targeting interventions such as managed comorbidities, reducing the burden of medications, education, and interventions to address nutritional and functional issues. If you look at what have been the results of the POSH program so far, you can see that, and this is, by the way, in 326 patients that underwent elective abdominal surgery, the median length of stay of patients that were enrolled in the POSH program for this specific patient population was significantly less. Same when you adjust by procedure and look at the readmission rate. There is a dramatic reduction in the readmission rate at 7 and 30 days on those patients that participate in the POSH program, even when you adjust that by procedure.
And perhaps that's one of the most interesting things I have seen. Think about the disposition after an elective procedure. Think about the impact of a program like POSH in programs like our comprehensive joint replacement, where we have, when we receive a bundle payment for taking care of our patients that have or that undergo hip replacement or knee replacement. The time, each day that these patients spend in the nursing home actually takes away funding for our institution. So having a program that helps us reduce the need of post-acute care or inpatient post-acute care will have significant impact on the amount of resources that we have to serve our population. So what are the basics of the POSH program? So I actually decotomized this in 5 steps. First, everything starts with the surgeon. Well, starts with the PCP as well. Okay? So the PCP will identify a patient that needs surgery. In the POSH program described at the VA, the PCP is the one who actually screens for these specific high-risk conditions. The PCP then refers the patient to the surgeon, and in the original version of the POSH program, at the surgeon's office is where this screening happens. I have to add that the POSH program here was initially designed, didn't include follow as a
maybe sick, maybe. I got it too.
So what happens after that visit occurs, then there is a quick visit that is made by the POSH Then there are single visits that occurs at the POSH clinic. It's multidisciplinary. It's either professional.
No, there's super fun cases today.
And it is
really
dumb.
That can
hope you all brought here. Actually, very honestly,
that's okay.
Good day. Doing top 10 off shelves for community practice.
Nice.
Hopefully, there's something bad about the lecture. So after that happens, and I will go through the details of what happens here in this visit. You know, surgery occurs, okay? And then there's, and again, as a part of the standard for the POSH, a post-op geriatric consult occurs while the patient is in the hospital. I personally believe, from my own experience in previous institutions, that our primary care base here in this institution could actually complete this visit. Actually, if they participate in the POSH program, they will be the best people to follow and avoid complications in the hospital. Why? Because they know their patients better. And then after the patient is discharged, they will what we call a common documentation visit, where there's a repository document where the surgeon, the physical therapist, the social worker, and the PCP or the geriatrician follow through this patient after the patient gets discharged. Do you have any questions about this flow? So what happens in the POSH visit? So the visit lasts 1 to 2 hours, and that's the caveat. Being a PCP myself, I wouldn't be able to actually have a program like this in my office, because how would I be able to block 2 hours of my day just for one single patient? It's just not practical. So sometimes once the PCP evaluates the patient, sometimes referring it to a POSH program's office, a visit, is the right thing to do. Not only because, you know, they will add to the already recommendations that PCP makes, but also they will have the resources and the time to identify and work in other risk factors. So during the visit, there is an extensive review of medical history, the medications. There are assessments of function that are being completed with standardized tools, geriatric tools. We assess, well, they assess mobility and cognition. There's assessment of mood that's extremely important. Untreated depression has been linked to adverse outcomes in pretty much every single surgical procedure. We assess caregiver support, and we assess goals and expectations. The only reason why this is so important, especially when we're talking about age caps, is because remember, by clarifying expectations, perhaps satisfaction increases. So it's not the same when patients will have the expectation that after a knee surgery or after a hip surgery, they will be able to go back and climb stairs, you know, on week two. And you realize perhaps that they're not able to climb those stairs, not because of the residual hip pain they have from the surgery, but also because they might have spinal stenosis that is leading to more difficulty ambulating. So clarifying expectations and looking for possible comorbid conditions that can affect the outcome, the desired outcome of the patient, is extremely important. So what kind of interventions occur? So the first one is delirium prevention. And it's extremely important. Why? Because perioperative delirium has been linked to adverse outcomes and excess mortality in every single surgical area. We assess mobility, or they assess mobility and nutrition. Poor nutrition is linked to poor wound healing, excess infection, and poor recovery. Medication management, trying to reduce the amount of medications that patients take. Which medications you need to stop the day of the surgery? Which medications you need to continue? What are the medications that can interact with anesthesia? What are the medications that interact with each other? And in the settings of the stress of surgery, can exacerbate conditions or can lead to poor outcomes. Defining advanced directives, and again, for a surgical procedure, usually, not to say well, or all the time, we need to revoke the DNR status. We're clarifying to the patient that it's a temporary measure and that the expectation is the DNR status or DNI status is resumed after the surgery. And planning for transitions and disposition. And why this is so important, and I want to just make a little parenthesis here. Older adults underestimate the actual disability that occurs after surgery. They tend to overestimate the amount of support they have to overcome that level of disability. So in any enhanced program for treating these patients, we have to be sure that the social support that the patients have matches the amount of predicted disability that this patient is going to have after surgery. So going back to what happens during the push visit, during a push visit, though, once we do this and then the patient undergoes surgery, again, in terms of the post-operative care, managing the medical condition is important, resuming the medications that are needed, holding the medications that are not, try to prevent delirium, treat pain, and most importantly, promote mobility and nutrition. Early mobility has been linked to good outcomes in pretty much every single surgical procedure. So, we're almost done. So, what are the barriers for programs like POSH? What do you think they are? Well, the first one is obviously this is a multidisciplinary intervention, coordination of schedules, knowing that the surgeon is going to see the patient, that the surgeon is going to send the patient to the POSH program, but the POSH program people have the clinic on Tuesdays and the patient needs, and there is no appointment until, you know, 2 weeks from now, and the patient will have the surgery in 3 weeks. I mean, that's one of the major problems that have is coordination of resources. The second one is communication. Although I have to admit that among us, we communicate really well. We know each other. We text each other. We see each other in the lounge and we discuss our patients. At a macro level, we suffer from the results of fragmentation, of care fragmentation. So our EMR systems sometimes are not, they don't talk to each other. The hospital EMR does not talk to the one in our offices. And sometimes we rely heavily on verbal communication between providers to coordinate the care and provide the care that our patients need. So communication is key. So that's why programs like POSH, they start with smaller groups. And then they build the, they expand the network as the program improves its benefits. Perception. Some of the geriatric faculty at Duke, actually, one of the things that they face at the beginning is that the PCP base of Duke, of the medical system, thought that this program might take patients away from them. And what happens is there was a change on culture where the PCP actually found herself being a participant in the program, and they feel proud about being part of the program, that they will offer an extra benefit to their patients by referring patients to these programs. Posh clinics are usually self-contained, meaning they have no other function but providing this specific intervention, and there is actually an agreement between PCPs and the Posh clinics to return their patients after the surgical procedure is performed and the patient fully recovers. And the other one is financial feasibility. As you can imagine, again, what we discussed at the beginning, you know, 1 or 2 hour office visits are not feasible in most of the environments where we practice. So at least at DBA, the Posh program that was implemented there counts with significant support from the system. Last slide. So what are the take-home messages from today? Demographics are changing. Older adults are not going anywhere. They will undergo surgery more often. And every time they will have more comorbid conditions, they will take more medications, they will be more frail. So we have to be prepared to take care of these patients. There are physiologic changes that occur with age. We cannot change them. But we can actually optimize the patients to avoid unnecessary harm after surgery. Look beyond the comorbid conditions. Remember, there are the social determinants of health that can influence the outcome of the patients, especially for the surgeons. So if you think about it, I can be the most skilled surgeon on earth, but if I don't take into consideration that my patient will need a family member to help them move to the bathroom the first 3 days, you know, my patient's going to fall, he's going to break a hip, and it doesn't matter how wonderful I am as a surgeon, my patient's going to have a poor outcome. Processes and standardized protocols. I mean, I have mixed feelings about order sets sometimes, especially because you order tests that sometimes you don't need. But for these programs to be successful, the literature suggests that having specific order sets for specific conditions improve outcomes and decrease resource utilization. Again, for the surgeons, that your surgical outcomes are affected by other factors different than your surgical skills. You can be the best surgeon on earth. If you don't pay attention to these things, you know, your numbers are going to be awful. And believe in co-management. And that's for my PCP colleagues. I mean, I think by communicating with people that could offer these services and having agreements where there is collaboration and not competition, we could build a network that can provide the care that our patients deserve. And with that, I'm done. Wow. I'm really sorry. Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you.